all I could do when I needed you was count on the fact that you'd be afraid of some sanction if you didn't help me, that's not the kind of world I think most of us want to live in, right? I want to be able to trust people.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Can you do anything useful without trusting someone?
Trust yourself. Trust yourself to do the things that only you know best. Trust yourself.
Isn't trust just for babies and fools?
The idea that we could get by without any trust at all, that just strikes me as impossible.
Isn't being trusted a greater compliment than being loved?
It's more than mere hope when I put my trust in somebody.
Our guest is Stanford philosopher Jorah Denenberg.
I think it's helpful to kind of try to imagine a life in which you really couldn't trust anybody and in which nobody trusted you.
Trust and mistrust.
Recorded live at the Mars Theater in San Francisco.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Continuing conversations that started down the road at Stanford University. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's trust and mistrust.
Well, I have to admit, Ken, I find the whole concept of trust sort of lame. It's just a nice sounding word for being stupid or helpless or both.
Oh, come on, John. You can't be serious. Look, families, societies, universities, every complex human institution is built on trust. The capacity to trust, that's one of the things, the main things that differentiates social animals like us from other animals. How could all this be if trust was just, how did you put it, a matter of being helpless or stupid or both? Come on, you can't be serious.
Well, let's take this one step at a time. Let's start with the logic of trust. We have a trustor, the person who does the trusting, a trustee, the person who is trusted. Then there's always some action that the trustor trusts the trustee to do.
Okay, that's a mouthful. I follow it, but I don't quite see the point just yet.
Okay, now second, think of that old Russian proverb that President Reagan liked to repeat, trust but verify. What does that mean? It means if the trustor trusts the trustee to do a certain action, then the trustor should verify, that is, find some guarantee that the truster will come through with that action.
I wasn't no big fan of Reagan, but that seems pretty commonsensical. If Gorbachev had told Reagan that he was going to disarm 100 missiles, it would have been very civilized, I guess, of Reagan to trust him. But he'd be remiss in his job as president of this great nation if he didn't insist on verifying that Gorbachev did what he said he would do. It was okay.
But then look at what you and the proverb are saying. Namely, he shouldn't trust him. The proverb is just an ironic way of saying, don't trust, verify. If you need a guarantee, you're not trusting. To trust someone to do something is to rely on them to do that thing without having any guarantees. But if you do that, you must be weak and have no choice or be stupid.
Sounds like you think trust is like always irrational or something.
No, because we often have no choice but to trust, like in all those institutions you named. We're forced to count on others all the time, but it's a weakness. Trust is just what we call this kind of helpless dependence on others. The newborn trusts its mother to provide care and nutrition. Has no choice. I trust PG&E or Con Ed to supply electricity 24/7. No choice. I trust Shell or British Petroleum to provide gasoline that won't make my car blow up. I've got no way to make sure any of these people will actually do what I count on them to do. I'm weak. So I say, I trust them.
I see what you're missing, John. I see what you're missing. Look, trust isn't an expectation with no guarantee, like you're presupposing. It's an expectation with a certain sort of guarantee. What kind of guarantee? The kind of guarantee you get when somebody makes a promise to you, for example. The truster relies on the trustee to be trustworthy, to live up to her word.
Well, but you can trust someone that you really don't believe to be trustworthy. I mean, Ferris Bueller's folks trusted him to behave responsibly. But you think they really believed that he would?
Well, I'm not sure about their psychology. That's not what I'm talking about. My point is that trust is one way, a certain way for counting on an outcome. His parents wanted to be sure he wouldn't throw a party or destroy the house. Well, they could have hired maybe a teen sitter to watch over him. They could have installed video cams. They could have chained him to the bedpost. That would have guaranteed it wouldn't have happened. But that would not have been trust. Instead, they relied on him because they thought he had a certain character trait, a certain virtue of doing what he said he would do. That's what trust is about.
All right, so I think I'm getting your picture. You see trust as a pattern of reliance where the truster isn't in a position to control what the trustee does. He may not even know what the trustee does at the time that's crucial, but he still thinks he can plan on the trustee doing one thing rather than another because of this character trait, trustworthiness.
Yes, that's exactly right. You've got it. And as I was saying before, this pattern of reliance, you know, relying on the trustworthiness of others, it's absolutely essential to human social life. Absolutely essential.
Well, Ken, I can always trust you to come up with some piddling objection to my compelling insights.
And now someone we both trust. That would be our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Escht. We sent her in search of situations where who you trust has the potential for big rewards. She files this report.
In the old TV game show, To Tell the Truth, three contestants all pretend to be the same person. One is telling the truth, the other two are lying. Then a panel of celebrities quizzes the contestants and tries to figure out who's real.
And now let's meet our next team of challengers. What is your name, please?
My name is Peggy Larson.
My name is Peggy Larson.
My name is Peggy Larson.
The show aired for 6 decades. In this 1966 episode, two imposters and one honest woman claim to be Peggy Larson, a scientist who studies ants. The panel quizzes the contestants and tries to sniff out the imposters.
All right, number three, are ants communists?
Well, sometimes they're red, if that's what you mean.
No!
A normal person who lies is quite easy to detect.
Christina Bicchieri teaches psychology and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies game theory and social norms, and she says game shows are the perfect microcosm to observe how people trust and how they deceive.
While if you lie to me, probably the color of your skin would change, maybe you would perspire a little bit, maybe you move the muscles of your face in a strange way, etc., etc. And I would be able to detect these subtle cues.
Bicchieri might be able to tell the liars from the truth tellers, but the celebrities couldn't. Only one guessed the right Peggy Larson. To Tell the Truth survived longer than almost any game show, in part because we like to test ourselves to see if we can spot a liar. Bicchieri points to studies where volunteers are shown pictures of people smiling.
And people say, oh, this is a fake smile, this is a real smile. I don't trust A, I trust B, exactly because people are very, very able. Think from an evolutionary viewpoint. We must be able to detect somewhat cheaters.
Today, we're still obsessed with programs that make games out of trust and betrayal.
This brings us to the moment that we have all been waiting for, where one decision could change a life forever.
In the show Take It All, players amass individual pots of money. By the end of the game, the two remaining contestants can decide privately whether to walk with only their pot of money or to try to take it all. If both decide to split the money, they each walk with their individual winnings. If both decide to take it all, they each walk with nothing. But if one decides to take it all and the other splits, the selfish contestant gets everything. You see how this can get heated.
But the interesting thing is that in the interaction with the other person, we get, unconsciously again, but very strong impressions about whether the person is trustworthy or not.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Take It All.
Go ahead. You're with each other.
Just off the top, I felt like as soon as I met you, that if I made it to the final round, I would hope it was you.
I felt the same way.
There's just something like, and I hate to cry right now, but there's just something genuine about you, and I hope that I'm reading you right.
You are. I felt the same way about you. There was a connection that we had together.
Okay, so this clip gives us a lot of information. Each player needs to decide how trustworthy the other is and whether they should share or be selfish.
All right, on the count of three. One. Two. Three. You, Anita, took it all. You have won a total of over $500,000, $554,300.
Christina Bicchieri has done trust experiments of her own, and she says that usually when two players are allowed to talk and make promises, they're less likely to screw each other over. Apparently, it's easier to cheat someone you've never met than it is to cheat your neighbor. Bicchieri also found participants were less likely to cheat if mirrors or even pictures of eyes were placed in front of them.
People may start perceiving that they are watched by somebody. And the mirror, you know, you look at yourself. And it's interesting, when people look at themselves, they seem to behave better.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for reminding us of the virtues of dishonesty. I'm John Perry, alongside with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. We're on stage at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And our guest today is also a professor of philosophy from Stanford University. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Jorah Dannenberg.
Hi, Jorah.
Welcome, Jorah.
Jorah, how did you get interested in this? Here's my bet. I bet you came from a small town where people left their doors unlocked and pretty much everyone trusted one another. And then you went to the big city, LA, to go to UCLA, and you were confronted by the first time by distrust. And so you ended up specializing in that topic. Do I have it right?
No. So just the opposite in a way. So I grew up in a big city where people locked their doors and where they didn't trust each other a lot. And it wasn't actually until I got about halfway into my dissertation. I was writing a dissertation about promising at UCLA. And one night I was talking to my mom about it, and she stopped me kind of midway through some esoteric argument I was kind of working on and said, you know, if your grandfather had lived to see you write this highfalutin dissertation about promising, he would have just been amused. I mean, he was a guy who lived in a small rural community where he really had to live by his word. He was a rancher, and he traded with other ranchers and business people, all on the strength of a word and a handshake. And in a way, it was a kind of reality check for me. It made me start thinking differently about why things like trust and word giving and promising matter so much to us, and what we might lose when we're not capable of trusting each other.
So how do you, or how might your grandfather have come down on that question that Ken and I were discussing? When your grandfather trusted someone to do something on a handshake, or someone trusted him to do something, what kind of guarantee did they have? Wasn't kind of irrational for them to expect the other one, like in the clip, it wasn't kind of irrational for them to expect someone to do something if they didn't have any other guarantee or way of checking?
Well, so I think I want to agree in one sense and disagree strongly in another. So there's a sense in which it's true there isn't a guarantee of one kind when you have to put your trust in another person. Though I think it's also right that a person's trustworthiness, their reputation, especially within a community where people really care about being trustworthy people and being able to put stock in one another's word, can really matter and provide a guarantee of sorts. And I don't think it's irrational to put trust in other people. I think this part, I strongly agree with the sorts of things Ken was saying at the beginning of the show. We need to be able to put our trust in one another.
But the fact that we need to put our trust in other people, I mean, that doesn't on its own make it, I wish it did, but that doesn't on its own make it irrational to put our trust in other people, because, you know, the back to the roving philosophical reporter. Oh, yeah, you're a good, honest fellow. Yeah, right.
Right. So people,
you know, and you know, that happens a lot.
Look, trust is the sort of thing that we want to be rational in trusting. That is, we want to make up our minds about whether or not to trust people in accordance with good reasons or good standards. In that sense, we try to be rational as trusters. But the idea that we could get by without any trust at all, that basically to the extent that we trust, we're just weak or foolish, or I forget exactly how John put it at the beginning of the show. That just strikes me as implausible. I think it's helpful to kind of try to imagine a life in which you really couldn't trust anybody and in which nobody trusted you.
Yeah, I like that word you use, implausible. I would have used a stronger word, silly. But this is Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco, where we're asking about trust and mistrust. Our guest is Dora Dannenberg, our newest colleague from Stanford University.
In our next segment, we're going to consider the central role that trust plays in our lives with one another.
Trust, rationality, and social life, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Yes, Jesus was a cross maker. Sweet silver angels over the sea.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Dora Dannenberg from Stanford University, and we're talking about trust and mistrust.
How often does the success of your actions depend on trusting other people, people who might even be complete strangers? Is trusting essential to your life or just a luxury afforded to you by having a few trustworthy friends? Step up to the microphones and join in.
So look, I've been trying to figure out what exactly it is to trust someone. Here, I'm going to try out a simple theory on you. Trusting a person is just relying on them. That's all trust is, reliance. What's wrong with that theory?
Well, so here's what's wrong with it. It seems like you can rely on somebody without trusting them. In particular, you can rely on their predictable habits or their kind of predictable behavior. Without actually trusting. Here's an example of what I mean. I live in a crummy apartment where I share a hot water heater with my neighbor, and every morning he takes a shower at exactly the same time, 8 o'clock in the morning. I rely on him to take his shower because I want there to be hot water 45 minutes later when I take my shower. But if he takes his shower later one day, I might be frustrated, I might be disappointed, I might be wet and cold. But one thing I can't say is I was betrayed by him. Right? He didn't betray my trust.
So you think trust is something that can be betrayed. So that shows it's more than reliance. Because
that's
something that my car breaks down. I rely on my car every day. It breaks down. I don't say, car, you betrayed my trust.
That's right. That's right. So we rely on things. We rely on people. We rely on agencies or corporations. And usually what that means is they're predictable up to a certain point, and we work predictions into our plans about how they'll likely behave. And it's true, when those predictions turn out to be false, we're left worse off, but we're not betrayed.
Let me ask you really quickly. Okay, so trust seems like it entails some kind of reliance, but reliance doesn't entail trust. So, I mean, trust is more encompassing than mere reliance.
I think that's right, and I think that the key for trust must have something to do with relying on a person's will or their character or the kind of motives they exhibit in doing the things you're relying on them to do.
But let's go back to your grandfather. You say all the people in this small town trusted one another, but what did that trust amount to? I mean, in a small town, as opposed to L.A., the circumstances are quite different. You know, if somebody says, oh, you want a new car? Well, take it home and we'll settle up tomorrow. He trusts you. Well, why does he trust you? Well, you're in a small town. If you don't come in tomorrow, he'll go find you. He'll tell all your friends. In L.A., it's a totally different situation. If you don't come back tomorrow, he may never find you. So isn't trust just a special form of prediction? Maybe he'll do what he says because something about the social situation will make the costs of not doing what he says unbearable.
Which puts it back to this reliance, because I can rely on his fearfulness of being caught to ensure that it's not his sort of intrinsic trustworthiness. It's the fearfulness of getting caught or what, you know, the cost of not doing what he says. That's back to a kind of reliance.
Yeah, so I think that's right. That just would be reliance. And I think it's important that we want to distinguish the difference here between making predictions about what people do based on attributing to them motives like fear of punishment or other kinds of self-interested motives, for example, and attributing to them trustworthiness, or at least the sorts of character traits or motives that we think make for trustworthiness in a person. So I think there'd be a difference, for example, between somebody thinking, oh yeah, he'll bring the car back, or he'll come back and pay for it because he knows we can find him and
we'll get kill him.
Yeah, we'll get him. Yeah. And thinking, no, this is a good guy. This is the kind of guy that we can count on, who will live up to his word, or who wants to be the kind of person that we can put our trust in, and who cares about us, about what we've entrusted to him.
So do you think that this postulated character trait, this trustworthiness, is that something real, something that some people have and some people don't, and that we're pretty good at assessing whether they have it or they don't?
Well, obviously from the video, we're not always as good at it as we'd like to be. I think it is something real. I think different people are trustworthy in different situations and with different people. And I think a lot of the task of being a person who needs to put their trust in others is getting good at or better at finding out who you can trust and when it makes sense to trust them.
And that's important, I think, for social life. Let's see if I'm getting the thought and the consequences of the thought. I mean, we could have all this monitoring machinery, you know, the sanction of the law, God's always watching, all that sort of stuff, and we could instill fear and all that. But that's costly. That's costly social engineering. Maybe the bigger our society gets, the more we've got to pay the cost. But in some situations, maybe we don't have to pay the cost. Maybe if people just have the virtue of trustworthiness, that stops us from having to carry around, you know, sticks and sanctions and all that.
I think that's absolutely right. But I would add something further, which is I think it's costly in another way. That is, life would be kind of depressing, impoverished, if that was all we had to go on with one another. If all I could do when I needed you was count on the fact that you'd be afraid of some sanction if you didn't help me, that's not the kind of world I think most of us want to live in, right? I want to be able to trust people.
So Hume had this example of the two farmers, right?
Yep.
And they each had a couple of acres, so it was hard to get all their crops in quickly. And if they did it first, he comes over and helps me, and then the next time I go over and help him, the next day, the next weekend, it would work better. And then he says, well, but what reason does the farmer who is the helper for the first weekend have to believe that the farmer will help him the next weekend? Now, is that his point, that somehow if the farmers can't trust each other, they're going to both lose their crops?
I actually think that is maybe a good way of thinking of what Hume's point is. That is, if all we have to go on is, sort of predictions about one another where we sort of attribute self-interest, we will find ourselves in these situations where we know if only we could cooperate, we'd both be better off, but we have no real way of putting our trust in one another. What Hume's farmers get out of the institution of promising in the story that Hume tells about how societies have to introduce this institution whereby they can give their word to one another is the ability to put trust in one another where they otherwise couldn't.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about trust and mistrust with Jorah Dannenberg from Stanford University in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in San Francisco. And we've got a whole lineup of questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Chris from San Francisco. The more I'm listening to these topics, the more it kind of makes me think, is it almost interchangeable with hope? Because when you're right in front of it and I'm looking at you, you know, I can hope that you will do me right. Also, if I'm driving down the freeway or getting on an airplane, it feels like these are all interchangeable to hope. Now, if that was the case, I don't understand where the weakness would lie. I mean, if you say that having faith, so to speak, in somebody or relying in somebody is a weakness, but it seems interchangeable with hope, how is that a weakness?
I think that was aimed at you, John.
I think he was pointing at you.
He was pointing at you.
Well, so you can imagine two different situations. One, you get on an airliner run by United or Southwest or some more or less reliable airliner, and you feel pretty good about it. You trust that the pilot knows what he's doing. Another case, you know, maybe the pilot has a heart attack, somebody volunteers from the passengers to go fly the plane, and you have no real reason to believe that he knows what he's doing, but you certainly hope he does. Right? Now, to the extent all you've got to work on is hope, it's not the same as, I mean, it is weakness, right? But if you've got more than hope, that means you've got some guarantee. So is that really a case of trust? That was the dilemma I was trying to provoke in the beginning.
I think in this sense, you might think hope and trust have something in common. They both sometimes involve a kind of positivity or optimism about somebody. The difference, I think, you might think about cases like John's airliner case. I mean, it's more than mere hope when I put my trust in somebody, right? I'm not only hoping that things turn out well, I'm expecting them to turn out well, in part because I expect the person whom I'm trusting to have the kind of character I think makes for trustworthiness.
So look, I want to go back to the Hume thing that you guys were talking about, which I think Hume, which I think is profound. Now, I'm a fan of kind of evolutionary thinking, and one might think that we must, as a species, have found a way to solve Hume's problem, because here we are in all these complex social things in which trust, well, let's put it this way, the need to rely on the other is rampant, and we don't live in like constant fear that the other is going to, not. So here's a thought, an optimistic thought. Maybe to some extent, humans are evolved not just to trust, but to be trustworthy. That this whole institution of trust and trustworthiness is built into human beings somehow. Do you think there's any?
I think I'm very attracted to that thought. And let me say a little bit more about the Hume case. I think there's two ways maybe you could think about Hume's farmers. One way, call it the kind of pessimistic way, is to think, look, they basically are the paradigm of the circumstances we find ourselves in. That is, we have to cooperate. We don't know who we can trust. We have this problem. How are we going to get around it? But another thing you could think about Hume's farmers is that they make clear to us why we're not in that circumstance most of the time in our lives, right? Why is it that I can walk up to a stranger and ask her, hey, would you mind watching my laptop while I go to the bathroom and put my trust in her? Well, it's in part because
you're stupid.
Some strangers.
Well, let's get some more questions. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm Harlan. I'm also from the Nexus of Mistrust, L.A., and I work in the nexus of businesses, the entertainment business. And I would like to hear what your thoughts about the relationship of power and trust. As a small fish dealing with large fish, there's often this issue of, can I trust this person? And the answer, more often than not, is no. That because someone has the power to abuse me, they will. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. Trust is often something we need when there are differentials in power. So I think it's unfortunate that it's often the case where we need trust the most is often also the case in which there's the most opportunity for exploitation or mistrust or exerting power over people in ways that we shouldn't. Children are powerless and have to trust their parents, and we tend to think, we hope, that most of the time that trust is merited. So it's not just power differentials as such that lead to mistrust. I won't say anything about the show business industry about why it's such a hotbed of mistrust, but...
But let me... So look, I think... Okay, trust is one thing, and trustworthiness is this capacity to be, there's reliability or something like that. But here's something that we do with one another. We make promises to one another. Mm. I know you study promises and think about promises a lot, and it seems to me that here's something I do when I make a promise to them. I to use a bit of Taylor vocabulary, I issue them an entitlement to rely on me. I say, John, I promise I will come tomorrow. Now, John has a kind of entitlement to rely on my coming tomorrow. He can plan on the basis of it or whatever, right? And it seems to me that human beings really are, in some sense, designed to issue such entitlements, to take up such entitlements from the other when they're and all that sort of stuff. And that's part of the glue of social life. So it can't just be, like you were saying earlier, that we're it's always rational to question. It's always rational to be skeptical of the trustworthiness of everything and everybody around you. If we were, none of this would have gotten off the ground. I mean, it just wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, I think that's got to be right. And I'll, again, add a further thought, which is that sometimes, though we think that it's important to be rational or reasonable about who we're going to put our trust in, that being too rational about trusting, or at least certain ways of being too rational about trusting, seem to kind of foreclose the possibility of trust from the get-go. So if I'm worried about whether or not I can trust you, and the way that I deal with that problem is hire a private investigator to track your every movement for a week, there's a sense in which I've already given up on the possibility of trusting you.
Don't you want to get in there?
Yeah, so we were talking about Hume.
Yeah.
And Annette Beyer, who's one of the persons mostly responsible for an article, she wrote an article about 20, 30 years ago that kindled a lot of interest in the topic of trust, particularly among women philosophers.
Yeah.
And she said, looking at Hume, whom she admires, but she said, Hume and all the men who've talked about trust, their example is always like two guys at a gentleman's club, making a bet about billiards or something.
Yeah.
And they just are clueless about the differential power relationships and how important trust is in those contexts. And if women philosophers wrote about it, it would be totally different. Now, for the last 30 years, there have been a lot of women philosophers writing about trust. Was she right? Do we have a different perspective now?
So I want to correct one thing you said, which is just that so Hume falls on the good side of the line.
Oh, he does.
For Beyer.
Okay.
She's very critical of some of the men in the tradition, but Hume and Mill in particular get singled out as men who had very strong women in their lives who benefited greatly from the experiences of the women with whom they were close. But I think you're quite right, and this is one of the things that makes trust such an interesting topic, is that there is a way in which the kind of dominant trend of moral philosophy is to think, look, the basic situation in which we deal with one another is as kind of free, equal, mutually powerful, disinterested parties who then just have to kind of negotiate a shared social world. And basically, we want to keep each other at arm's length, and we want to make sure that, you know, you don't get in my way while I'm reading my paper at the social club, I think is Beyer's example.
Right.
And I think she's quite right to say, look, that's just a very narrow view of moral life, not only because it leaves out the experiences of women or children or various other people who don't stand in relations of social equal to social equal, but even for people who do.
So when there are power differentials, And you want to share, it sounds like the message I'm getting is something, and you want a shared life between the more powerful and the less powerful, unless there's a high degree of trust, right? Because the powerful have the less powerful at their disposal in a way, but if the less powerful want to participate in it, they have to have some degree of trust that their stake in that life will be respected. Is that the kind of idea? And this free equal person's is blind to that fact.
Well, I think that's a good place to start. And I think it also raises a question about the responsibilities of being trusted. And I think this can maybe help us get back to thinking about Harlan's question. If you think about these situations in which there are differentials in power, you might think that places some responsibility on the powerful, in whom sometimes the less powerful have to put their trust because they have no choice.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about trust and mistrust with Jorah Dannenberg from Stanford University.
If we're living in a global society that relies upon bonds of trust between complete strangers, then are we screwed? Can we really trust one another?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
His trusty will do the wrong thing. His trust, he will do the wrong thing.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jorah Dannenberg from Stanford University, and we're digging into trust and mistrust, and we've got a question from our live audience right over there. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Laura. I'm from San Francisco, And it seems like so far in the discussion we've been talking about trusting based on someone giving their word or some assurance, but it seems like we trust people a lot more than that. And so I wanted to ask, what kind of responsibility does a person have when they are trusted, even if they didn't invite that trust, if someone just kind of by default trusts them? Because it seems like when you're trusted, it's you're taking on a kind of burden, some sort of responsibility, and maybe you don't want that. So what do you do when someone trusts you and maybe you didn't invite it, you didn't ask for it, and maybe you don't even want it?
Got an answer to that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. We often trust very deliberately, and when we give our word to one another, that's sometimes when we're at our most deliberate. But it's also true that a lot of trust is less deliberate, not deliberate at all, unreflective. Sometimes we just sort of fall into trusting people. Sometimes we never become aware of it. In fact, interestingly, often we're most aware of the fact that we were trusting somebody only when the trust gets betrayed.
But can a person betray a trust that wasn't, you know, explicitly offered? I decide to trust John. He never invited me to trust him, but I just decide to trust John. Can John betray my trust in that situation?
Suppose, take a hypothetical example. Suppose Ken gives me a Super Bowl ring at a party. And I put it in my pocket and walk off with my Secret Service men. Have I betrayed his trust? I never promised to give it back.
Seriously, can I mean, but the question was, yeah. We trust people a lot more than explicit promises. But can a trust like that be betrayed?
Yeah, so I think it can possibly, and probably the specific answer is going to depend more on the details. Here's what I will say about that part of the question, namely the part about what sorts of responsibilities we have when other people put their trust in us. I think any time I become aware that somebody is trusting me, even when I didn't invite the trust, in fact, even if I went out of my way to try to discourage the person from putting their trust in me, I think I have a certain responsibility to do something. Now, whether I have a responsibility to do the thing that I'm being trusted to do, that seems to me a further question. But one thing I can't do is pretend as though the trust isn't going on, as though I'm off the hook because, so to speak, I didn't invite it. Trust makes people vulnerable to us. And when others are vulnerable to us, we have to take care that we're at least responsible about that vulnerability.
But there's this song from the Flower. There's this. When I was in high school, I was part of the pit orchestra for the Flower drum song. And there's a song where they had this arranged marriage, and the guy says, "Don't marry me if you want to. I'm devoted to my teenage mother, blah, 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 blah," right? And he says, "Don't marry me." But she doesn't really have a choice because it's an arranged marriage. He's basically saying, if you marry me, I'm going to be a lousy husband. Suppose they went through with the arranged marriage. You think he has some kind of obligation not to be a lousy husband because, I mean, he warned her. He warned the parents. Mm-hmm. He warned everybody. You think he would have had, they didn't end up getting married, but you think he would have had some obligation to be a great husband when he said, "Don't marry me, baby"?
Yeah, so lost a little bit at the end because they didn't get married, right?
Right, yeah.
So I think even warning somebody explicitly, "Hey, look, I'd prefer that you not trust me on this. Maybe you should put your trust in somewhere else or make a backup plan." If I learn that you're trusting me anyway, like I said, I think the one thing I'm sure you couldn't do responsibly in that situation is just pretend like the trust wasn't there. I may not be responsible for doing everything it is that I'm being trusted to do, especially when I've warned people not to trust me. But the idea that I could just sort of go on and pretend as though somebody else wasn't vulnerable, yeah, that seems incorrect to me.
We got a question over here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name's Devin. I'm from Montreal. I wanted to take it out of the realm of interpersonal trust and ask about trust in institutions. You know, parents sending children to school or us telling Facebook what we do every day, and that they're not going to turn that over to a certain other large entity that we trust sometimes or don't. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that kind of implicit or explicit trust that we give to non-persons.
Is it trust? I mean, is it the same phenomenon that when I, you know, count on corporations to do things as when I count on people that are my kith and kin to do things? Can it be? Is it always? I mean, I'm not sure I trust any corporation in the sense in which I trust another human being. I don't think that they have some kind of inner set of feelings that I can rely
on. Corporations aren't people?
No. Not many.
I think one of the ways to kind of try to think about this question is to think, well, look, of course, within corporations are people who occupy, or institutions are people who occupy the roles that help to make up that institution. And so we still face a question about whether to trust or how much trust to put in a particular person when that person is the superintendent of the school district or that person is the clerk at the county office. I think there's also a question we need to kind of ask, an abstract question in a way, about what we want out of social institutions and how much we think they should be opportunities for putting trust in one another, or how much we think they should be, so to speak, betrayal proof, right?
I think this is a really interesting, subtle question, and I hadn't really thought about it before, but there's a kind of trust that person A trusts person B. Person B invites person A to trust. That's some kind of interpersonal relationship. But then there are persons in roles within large institutions. I don't really have a direct interpersonal relationship with that person in that role in the institution. I have some kind of relation to the institution, and I might rely on the institution to be such, and I might, in a way, rely on them to play their role within the institution on which I rely. But that's not me actually trusting them, because I'm not directly personally related to them in this way.
Well, so I'm not so sure I agree with that, right?
Okay.
So don't you think that in those kinds of circumstances, it's possible to find yourself relying not only on the fact that the institution is set up in such a way that there will be checks and balances in place that they will perform reliably, but that you will expect them to have certain kinds of motives or traits of character that make them good doctors or honest lawyers?
Yeah, I would really like it if teachers, I have a son, so I deal a lot with teachers and principals and stuff, loved children. I would like it a whole lot if they loved children and that they operated out of their motivations were love for children. But, you know, they have all kinds of pressures that prohibit them from promising to me the things I would like them to promise. Mm-hmm. That you will treat my son as a person extra special, brilliant, you know, blah, blah, blah. That you will always evaluate him as I would. They can't do that because of their institutional role. So my relations to them are mediated by their institutional role. And that seems to take it out of the realm of sort of basic level trust and distrust and all that. You don't think that's right at all? I mean, it's an inchoate thought because I just had it for the first time. But, you know.
Well, I'll give you an inchoate answer then and we'll be even. Look, so it seems to me, of course, the fact that I'm interacting with someone who is occupying a role with an institution matters and changes the nature of the kind of interaction that I have with them. And so in the particular example you were talking about, sure, certain things that I might like to be able to trust a teacher to do, maybe not only can I not trust the teacher to do, in fact, I know they won't be able to do it given the institution. At the same time, I think we do find ourselves interacting in ways that are nevertheless opportunities for trust in one another. And so you might think, well, look, within the confines of what your son's teacher is able to do, how much trust do I have?
Yeah, in, and right? It's not just reliance, but let's get some more questions in here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Val, and I'm actually from New York City, but I live in San Francisco now. Just zooming out on some of the topics that we've touched on, gender, power, children, education, all of that, just zooming out a bit more extremely and thinking about the implicit trust of whether it be divinity or biology that has decided, for instance, that women are the vessels through which lives are ushered into existence. And speaking of unsolicited trust, you know, every female that's born is just trusted to do that, whether they decide they want to be a part of that process or nay. And so I guess, is it really possible that the playing field of trust will ever be level? Because for now, it's a relatively disproportionate role that's played. So there's some implicit trust from some entity that is as yet undefined that this side of human existence is trusted for this process. Do you have any thoughts on that? Will the playing field ever be level?
That's a big question. Here's, it seems to me, what we should want to think about in response to this kind of challenge. Where is there the opportunity to make the playing field more level than it is, right? So if trust is the kind of thing that's a human good that makes a person's life better, that, you know, without which life would seem impoverished, then every person as such has an interest in being able to enter into relations of trust, to be trusted by others and to find others in whom to put her trust. And it's clearly the case that that opportunity is not, so to speak, equally distributed among people. People face challenges in virtue of characteristics that we regard as arbitrary, or at least that we think we should regard as arbitrary, in being able to solicit trust from one another and being able to enter into trusting relationships. We can surely make progress and do better than we can, even if we recognize that, to a certain extent, there will be power differentials that we don't ever get beyond.
Well, that's a good closing thought, and a thought worth ending on. It's kind of inspiring. Our guest has been Jorah Dannenberg from Stanford University. Jorah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, John, are you inspired to be more trusting, you cynical guy? You?
Well, I'm pretty trusting. I'm thinking, you know, there really is kind of a bifurcation in trust between just kind of faith of a helpless person that the situation he's in is, or she is in, is one that will turn out well, versus an active reliance on some other person because of some inferred or perceived property of trustworthiness. And if so, it's important not to confuse the two.
Oh, it's definitely important not to confuse the two. But I do want to say, I think Jorah is right, that without this second thing, this active trusting on another in virtue of character traits, really without it, we'd all be kind of hyper-skeptical of one another and ever on the watch. And I just don't think we could possibly get along in a world like that.
We'd all be like lonely, skeptical philosophers.
Yep, questioning everything. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very, very active Facebook page.
And now, in Speed We Trust, it's our very own 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes.
Ian Scholes. Because America sometimes has trust issues when it comes to voting rights, Section 4 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act determined which areas in the United States must be cleared by the federal government before changes are made to voting procedures, like moving a polling place or a voting district. Well, the Supreme Court has now ruled that section is unconstitutional. Pretty much immediately, Texas announced that it would put its new voter ID law into effect. Some liberals are worried this new ruling will make gerrymandering a snap. Well, where's the trust? Because the federal government is now smaller by one provision, conservatives are delighted. Chief Justice John Roberts struck a further note of hope. The current coverage system, he wrote, quote, is based on 40-year-old facts having no logical relationship to the present day. Congress must identify those jurisdictions to be singled out on a basis that makes sense in light of current conditions. It cannot simply rely on the past. Congress must ensure that the legislation that passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions, unquote. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa took an historical perspective. The legislation was no longer needed. Quote, what it tells me is after 45 years, the Voting Rights Act worked, unquote. Senator Grassley's and Justice Roberts' faith in the system is touching. Some have described life inside the Beltway as being inside a big, vicious bubble. That bubble has not burst for these forward thinkers. They possess something, it seems, that has been all but lost in these troubled times, trust. A trust by Senator Grassley that all wrongs have been righted. The trust by Justice Roberts, well, the Voting Rights Act was sufficient to right whatever wrongs were done in the past, but does no longer suffice to right theoretical wrongs of the present and future. Justice Roberts apparently believes passionately that Congress will upgrade the racist wrongness detectors in a fair and sensible manner. This trust is amazing. We've just seen in June that Congress couldn't even pass a farm bill, which Congress itself supported. I didn't even know such a thing was possible, but there it was. Of course, Congress will vote against Obamacare time and again. We can all trust in that. But trusting them to look deep into their own hearts, be honest and truthful, to find modern instances of racism and voter suppression right there in their own districts, find it, and then pass wise and responsible legislation that will guarantee hassle-free voting to all citizens, regardless of race, politics, or personal belief systems, well, that kind of trust is both rare and stirring. And it might lead to greater things. There's the proposed amendment to the upcoming immigration bill, for instance, which would make the border between the U.S. and Mexico, in the words of Senator John McCain, the most militarized border since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Even though immigration from Mexico to the U.S. dropped to, well, zero in 2011, there is a trust, it seems, that the U.S. economy will come roaring back, and with it the swarm of illegal immigrants that will keep that economy ticking along without, we trust, the right to vote. And of course, even if they do finally get the right to vote, good luck finding the polling booth. That will be on a need to know. Thank you, Justice Roberts, for allowing us at last to once again trust in ourselves. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is the presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Christopher Meyer, and Tyler Haddow.
Thanks also to our philosopher of sound, Dan Brandon, and our philosopher of words, Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strelovich. The brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our embarking director is the worldly and wise Dave Millar. And Carola Kreitmeyer is our one and only performance consultant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, local public radio in San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the views of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.